What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Jesse Strauss.
For 4 days in September of 1971, prisoners revolted, taking over the institution that incarcerated them in upstate New York. By the time the dust settled in Attica, 33 prisoners and 10 guards or staff had been killed. Notably, all but one guard and three prisoners were killed by law enforcement gunfire when the state violently retook control of the prison. While the Attica Rebellion has become fairly widely known, our guest today has written a powerful book that reframes that rebellion not as a singular uprising, but as one important piece that frames a series of rebellions by prisoners engaging in tactics that include counterviolence against the violence of the white supremacist capitalist framing of our society itself, asserting that U.S. prisons are literal sites of war. Our guest is Orisanmi Burton, a professor of anthropology at American University, who describes this framing in his book as the Long Attica Revolt, or in description, quote, revolutionary struggle for decolonization and abolition at the site of the U.S. prison. His book is called Tip of the Spear, Black Radicalism, Prison Repression, and the Long Attica Revolt. Before we get into the content, I think it's also worth mentioning up front that prisoners in at least New York, Florida, Michigan, and California have been banned from reading the book under fears that it may itself incite rebellion. That's a claim that our guest today rejects. Orisanmi, thank you for joining us on Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me and for the introduction. It's a pleasure.
It is a pleasure to have you. I really appreciated diving into your book, and I'm sure I have more questions than we're going to have time to talk about today. But let's start with an overall framing. You write that prisons in the U.S. are best understood as technologies of domestic warfare masquerading as apolitical instruments of crime control. I'm wondering if you can break that down for us. In your view, how do U.S. prisons masquerade as something they're not, and how are they, in fact, sites of war?
Wow, sure. Yeah.
That's a small question, I know.
Yeah. I'm not making a argument about all prisons in all places at all times. I'm making an argument about the function of U.S. prisons at a particular historical moment, a moment that we're still in. But it's one that really begins, if we had to pick a date, I would say 1967 is as good of a date as any to mark the emergence of this carceral warfare project, as I've called it elsewhere, right? And this is a coherent political project organized by various factions, reactionary factions within the national security state and the sort of local, state, and federal carceral apparatus in the United States to more strategically and intensely weaponize the prison against radical and revolutionary movements in the U.S., which were intensifying in the U.S. At the time, 1967, right? There are several developments ideologically within the various movements that are increasingly abandoning the sort of civil rights frameworks that had prevailed in prior generations and which were primarily oriented around fighting for fuller inclusion into U.S. society, fighting against discrimination, fighting for recognition under the law. That's still there. It's always a tendency within movements, but we see this broader shift around questions of decolonization within the United States and movements like the Black Panther Party, which, of course, the FBI identified as the greatest threat to national security. He made that claim in 1968, right? A year into the development of this warfare project. These movements really start to intensify and they start to adopt internationalist conceptions of revolutionary politics and struggle, of course, influenced by movements for decolonization, that are unfolding throughout the world. And so the book really looks at how the prison is responding to this dynamic, right? And it's a dynamic that I think is best understood as a war dynamic. The primary organizers of this campaign were thinking explicitly in terms of war. J. Edgar Hoover, the director of the FBI at the time, is one of them, but there's many others. And several of these figures, as I detail in the book, had actually participated in counterinsurgency efforts elsewhere in the world, in the decolonizing the colonies, former British colonies, in the former French colonies, Vietnam. There were people circulating within and beyond these contexts. And these are the people that helped to reform and revise, improve, and develop prisons to become instruments of counter-revolutionary warfare. And they masquerade as instruments of crime control. They masquerade as apolitical instruments. There's a sense of due process, right? There's a discourse of due process. But when we actually look at how political movements were attacked and neutralized using this machinery, we can see how it has been weaponized in this period to take the most intelligent, the most militant, the most audacious political activists and organizations out of circulation. And so that's really what I mean. And so I'm using archival evidence and oral history to try to trace that transformation.
Thank you, Ori. One of the places you started there was to mention that this historical period that you reference in the Long Attica Revolt is still a historical period that we're in. You also argue that the Long Attica Revolt and prison rebellion within that historical period is abolitionist organizing. And again, before we get into a little bit more of Attica, I'm wondering if we can contextualize that. It's important as we talk about abolitionist organizing to recognize a historical context of what abolition is and what abolition has fought against over centuries. I know this is not the primary subject area of your book, but it seems like a framing tool.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. We're in a historical context in which abolition is a term that's very much in circulation. It's something that people identify with. It kind of stands in for a kind of general left politics, right? And so I'm actually kind of pretty critical of the way that abolition has been co-opted and basically now is just kind of a stand-in for social justice as a term. My friend and interlocutor Dylan Rodriguez makes this point all the time. Social justice itself is a term that, you know, was co-opted and has been divested of its radical content, right? And so part of what I wanted to do here, I don't spend a whole lot of time in the book theorizing about abolition, or really, I don't know, some people might disagree. I don't think I spend a whole lot of time theorizing about anything. Really, what I wanted to do is to show important theoretical concepts in motion, show them as they are being deployed and contested by people who are engaged in struggle. And to the extent that that concept is useful, I hope that people will sort of want to sink their teeth into it. And so abolition is one of those terms that's key to the book. One of the arguments that I make is essentially that abolition, contrary to popular belief, perhaps wasn't cooked up in a library, the concept of it. I think people could come into an abolitionist consciousness at this historical moment and think that, you know, academics with PhDs like me are the ones who came up with the idea because we're the ones who are putting it in circulation in a particular kind of way. And so part of what I wanted to show is actually how abolition, prison abolition, grew out of a criminalized tradition of Black radicalism, right? That incarcerated Black revolutionaries, militants, people who were pathologized as mentally ill, people who were not seen to have any kind of value to society, who were not treated as intellectuals, that these are some of the ones that elaborated that concept and thought through the contradictions of that concept in really concrete ways. And that abolition at this time, right, we're talking about the late 60s and early 70s, we're talking about people like George Jackson and other lesser known figures who I try to illuminate in the book. We're talking about the way that they were thinking through abolition, not as the sort of singular sign of a left politics, but as one among many of concepts of political transformation. So abolition was in circulation alongside decolonization, alongside terms like revolution and liberation. And people were struggling with the meaning of these terms, not so that they could write well-received books, but because they felt that clarifying these ideas was essential to their success as people who understood themselves to be revolutionaries. And so some of the figures in my book are abolitionists. Some of the figures are not, but they have left critiques of abolitionism, right? And so I wanted to kind of bring that dialogue and some of those tensions and contradictions to light. Because I think now we're in a moment where there's this kind of liberal hegemony that has sucked all the oxygen out of the concept. And so we're not able to really think about it critically. It's just something that people think that they're supposed to accept if they understand themselves to be on the left.
You know, even though this was not the primary research focus or the primary framing of your book, it was incredibly interesting to me, and I really appreciated that work that you do there, and thank you for this description you just offered. You reference the late 1960s as the beginning of the particular historic period that you call the Long Attica Revolt. Again, one more before we get into Attica. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you can help us frame some of the political context and political actions, historical actions that took place, that also illustrate the relationship between inside and outside organizing as it relates to prison revolt, and the three pieces that I drew from your book that are very important, although there are so many more, are the Panther 21 case in New York, and then the revolts at Auburn, and also the San Quentin Rebellion, in which George Jackson was killed.
Right. So, okay. There's so many ways that one could approach this. What I'll say is that I talked about the intensification of militant anti-colonial resistance in the U.S., which is intensifying in the 60s. One of the ways that this gets expressed is through urban rebellions. There are hundreds of them in U.S. cities. You know, the historiography typically starts with the Harlem Rebellion of 1964. And they erupt for several years, and they start to taper off in, you know, like 1972 is a big year as well. So between 1964 and 1972, there are hundreds and hundreds of urban rebellions in the U.S. Some of them are relatively small. Some of them are massive, like Detroit, like Watts, you know, like Newark, right? And not only are they massive in scale and the amount of property destruction they cause, they're also showing signs of intensifying organization. In terms of the internal organization of the forces that are organizing those rebellions. And so there's an interesting history to that. The state starts to think about them, these rebellions, as guerrilla warfare, as revolutionary warfare. And so they they start to use the same tactics that they used internationally against these rebellions. So this is sort of the prehistory of the history I lay out in the book, because what's not known, what I just said is known, that's widely known. What's lesser known is the fact that, you know, I say the Carceral Warfare Project launches in roughly 1967. Well, between 1968 and 1972, we see an intensification of prison rebellions. And so the state starts to incarcerate these movements as an attempt to take them out of circulation. But I argue that this essentially backfired, and it helps the people inside prisons to transform prisons into these zones of militant political education and political praxis and rebellion. And so this shows up in all kinds of ways, as you suggested. One of the things that happens is, you know, the Panther 21, which is one of the most clear examples of what I'm talking about, the state using the prison to take militants out of circulation. And so essentially, you know, the New York Police Department, the Bureau of Special Services and Investigation, which is like their political police force, simultaneously arrest 21 Panthers, put them all in jail. They indict them for various acts of terrorism against the New York City population, which, just as an aside, if you understand anything about the Panthers' political philosophy and their desire to bring more people into their politics and into their organization and build a mass political party, just on its face, the claim that they were going to bomb department stores and police stations that are in Black neighborhoods, it just is illogical. But that was the claim. And, you know, it was the most expensive trial in New York history at the time. It went on for over 2 years, and all of them were found not guilty because they had very little evidence. And what evidence they did have was planted by agent provocateurs who had infiltrated the party. So, in other words, the most militant of the arrestees who were talking about bombing things and who had dynamite in their possession, these were all later found out to be undercover police officers. It just so happens that a rebellion erupted while the Panthers were in the Queen's House of Detention. They didn't start it because they were all in isolation. But when this rebellion happened, other prisoners let the Panthers out of their cells and elected three of them to the leadership committee of the rebellion. And what unfolds is an intensely organized and politicized rebellion, which is sort of the opening moment of the Long Attica Revolt, which is this protracted prison struggle. And the rebellion that happened in Queens is only one of multiple rebellions that happened simultaneously in the New York City jail system in 1970. And so this, again, is an example of what I'm talking about how this strategy of incarcerating militants essentially backfires and helps the prison become the primary site of radical political thought, right? So it's not just about rebellions in the sense of, oh, they're seizing power, seizing control of infrastructure, but they're actually producing and circulating knowledge. They're writing things. They're communicating with people in the outside world, including people outside of the United States. There's an internationalism that grows, right? And so after this, there's another rebellion that happens in Auburn prison that I spend chapter two talking about. And all of this sort of culminates in Attica. And so as a narrative strategy, I talk about them as separate rebellions. And then I use the term revolt to refer to this longer movement, this distended mm-hmm. project that is unfolding mm-hmm. across different carceral sites.
And that's all New York, but rebellion in prisons, and of course also in the streets, as you're referencing the Panthers, and we are right now, I am in Oakland, California. We have a lot of that history here. We know that history is not only isolated to New York. How does California prisons, and in particular George Jackson, but also rebellion beyond New York, play into this framing?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, California and New York were the two key sites of the prison movement. And the term the prison movement, to my knowledge, is something that George Jackson certainly popularized as a concept. And he theorized what that movement was, what it was about. And it was not about incarcerated people getting better treatment while they're incarcerated, right? It was, in fact, a revolutionary movement. It was about how the most militant, courageous, intelligent people who are able and willing to fight against the status quo are to be found in prison. And so, therefore, the prison is a key site of organizing. And so Jackson did a tremendous amount of theorizing in his two books, as well as in his articles. And the theorizing he was doing was a synthesis of what he was learning in study groups from a range of lesser known figures. So California and New York were really at the cutting edge. But I mean, it's interesting, there's a prison movement happening in France at the same time. There's a prison movement happening in South Vietnam at the same time. So here's an example, right? In 1970, there was the Folsom prison strike. The demands that were collectively authored through that strike were subsequently sent to New York, and they were used as the basis for the Attica Liberation Faction's manifesto of demands. So the brothers in Attica received the demands that brothers in Folsom had used. They revised those demands so that it made sense to their context in New York and submitted them to prison officials in New York. Subsequently, these demands apparently make their way to prisoners of war in South Vietnam, who then revise those demands and submit them to prison officials in South Vietnam. Now, at the time, the person who was in charge of the prison system of South Vietnam was a man by the name of Donald Bordenkercher, who was on loan from the California prison system. They tapped him in 1967, right? The beginning of this carceral warfare project. Mm-hmm. The Office of Public Safety, which is basically a cover for the CIA, taps him and sends him to Vietnam to oversee the reform, development, renovation, improvement of the prison system, specifically around combating communism, right? So the prison is being used explicitly for counterinsurgency. And according to him, those prisoners got a hold of the same demands and issued a similar version of them. Since we're talking about Bordenkercher, this wasn't your question, but just to give you a sense of the international connections and the connections to war that I'm talking about.
Sure.
Decades later, after the U.S. military and CIA torture scandal in Abu Ghraib prison, Bordenkercher then goes to Iraq, where he's brought in to manage the fallout from that torture scandal and sort of get that prison under control in the wake of that controversy.
So a big part of this is communication and strategizing kind of on both sides amongst prison officials on how to bring methods of incarceration on prisoners, as well as on prisoners how to organize within their context. We're in conversation with Orasanmi Burton, whose book we're discussing. It's titled Tip of the Spear, Black Radicalism, Prison Repression, and the Long Attica Revolt. Ori, we've alluded to Attica a number of times. Let's get into it. I don't want to spend so much time talking about the details, but I think a little bit of what actually happened in that prison for 4 days in 1971 will ground our listeners, and I will encourage our listeners also to read the book and learn more in depth elsewhere, because there is so much to build from. But these other elements of the Long Attica Revolt that you say starts in 1967, lands in the Attica prison. This is just a few months after the Panther 21 case ends, where all the Panther 21 members are acquitted. That's in June of 1971. And then a few months later, September 1971.
Yep. And in between, George Jackson is assassinated, right? So then another connection, right, is that when George Jackson is assassinated, all the brothers in Attica who idolized George, they were reading his stuff, right? They knew who he was. And they had really tight communication networks. So according to them, they found out almost instantly, right? And they organized a silent fast in the mess hall. So the next day, they wore black armbands and they went into the mess hall and nobody ate. It was, and nobody spoke. It was dead silence. And it was at that point that the sort of guards became terrified because of that level of solidarity and discipline, right? The prison thrives on division. And to see a unified population like that was extremely disconcerting for the administrators. It's good that we've been talking about Attica, but not really talking about Attica for this long, because this is sort of the point of the book. It's that, you know, the historiography of Attica has fixated on the sort of those 4 days as the crux of the issue. But, you know, I argue that Attica is like a genealogy that unfolds in temporally and geographically expansive ways, and that it continues before and after the event. The event itself is, you know, we could spend days talking about it. I think it's a, you know, you asked me earlier about abolition, and I forgot the most important part of the answer. The answer to the question is, if you want to know what abolition is, then you should study Attica and the way that I'm encouraging people to study Attica, because I argue that it's actually the unfolding of abolition in practice, right? And so much of the abolitionist theory that we read and encounter is people, individual scholars who are very brilliant and very great with words, musing on what abolition is or trying to theorize it. And I think that that's valuable. But in Attica, if we actually read the practice of Attica, we understand abolition as a praxis, right? And so there were both destructive and constructive elements, right? And so in terms of the destructive element, they tore down the walls in a very literal way, as many of the walls as they could, right? They created space for themselves within a carceral regime. They disabled the carceral regime, which had prevented them from being in common. It had prevented them from meeting their own needs. It had prevented them from doing all kinds of things. And so they created space for themselves. And I try to narrate how they did that, right? And it's not pretty, right? But it is what it is. Then they created this space, this opening, and there's all kinds of possibilities that could have happened. One of the possibilities that could have happened was that the rebellion at that point just implodes on itself, that people just turn on each other, right? There's no shortage of people in prison who don't like each other, who have beefs for various reasons. And so it could have just descended into that. But they made a conscious decision. The people, the leaders among the population made a conscious decision to not do that, and to use this opportunity to demonstrate to the world what is possible. And I think what they show us is abolition happening, unfolding. So they create an alternative political order, right? They hold elections and rearrange the physical geography of D Yard, which is the place that they were occupying, right? They create spaces for medical care. They create spaces for political discourse. They create spaces for intimacy and sexuality. They bring all of their bedding outside so they can sleep under the stars. And they actually spend time looking at the stars and contemplating the stars. They do all kinds of things, right? And so they create a political order. They experiment with new kinds of humanity, new kinds of sociality, new kinds of intimacies. I spend a lot of time talking about that. It's a book about war, but it also shows that the sort of object of this war, at least for the militants, was not just to achieve domination. It wasn't to reverse the situation of dominance. It wasn't to take the master's place, but it was to create a new space, new kinds of spaces for sociality. All that happens in Attica over these 4 days. So it's 4 days, but a lot is compressed in these 4 days. They create a really intensive apparatus for self-defense, which I talk about, right? They start to improvise developing new kinds of weapons, not to enact violence against their keepers, but to defend themselves. And how we know this is that they had the opportunity to enact massive retribution against these guards. They had 30 guards that were hostage, and they had a conversation about it, and they decided not to do that. Again, in order to show the world that there are other ways to enact power over people that you don't like, right? And that, so I think that that was extremely important. And then there was a profound internationalism, which I try to outline in the book. And so I'll end on this note, which is the story of Attica has been told and retold numerous times. But I think that even if you've read all the other ones, I think you would learn a lot from this one, because this one leans into the aspects of the story that I think have been systematically erased, right? Which is the radical anti-colonial and revolutionary content of the rebellion. Before this book, the primary focus had been on the negotiations between incarcerated people and the state for improved prison conditions, which is important, but I think it's extremely important to understand that if we just focus on that, we miss what the leaders of Attica thought was most important.
And a lot of that previous resources available publicly were not truly primary source. They're relying on the narratives from police in the state that were also intrinsically defending themselves. It's something that you do powerfully in your book, and spending what I understand to be about a decade of long research in conversation with people either who were part of Attica or in some version part of the longer Attica revolt. That was powerful to see. I actually have a question. I want to get into that a little bit later. But while we're talking about Attica, I want to touch on the demands being made, and in particular, what you described as demands made of progressive forces for a new world, which goes beyond demands made just of the prison and just of conditions, but the demands also relate to a kind of program within the prisons of pacification.
Thank you for asking the question. This was something that was really important for me to articulate. I'm not sure that I'm not sure that we know what demands are. I think that there's a tendency for the people to whom demands are being addressed, or just publics, to flatten demands and to make them seem like they're all the same thing. I think that, you know, there are different, I try to show that there are these different categories of demands. So, and there's a lot of policing of demands happening, right? So I'm arguing that Attica was revolutionary, okay? So it's intention with more pragmatic forms of politics in terms of, okay, let's negotiate only the possible, right? And so, like, as soon as Attica happened, they wrote a list of demands. They called it the immediate demands. One of those demands was like, we want transportation to a non-imperialist country. Another one was like, we want you to take all the internal walls of Attica down, right? Attica's divided into four pieces. They were like, take all those down, right? They just said what they wanted, right? And as soon as they had an emissary, a representative from the state come in, they showed him the immediate demands and he said, these are unrealistic. Give me some more. And so then they wrote another list of demands. And these were called the 10 practical proposals. And then eventually what typically gets rendered as the Attica demands is a longer list. I think it was published in the New York Times. This is a list that was produced by a community of outside observers who translated what they thought or what they wanted or what they, you know, they translated what the incarcerated people were saying into a kind of petition bullet pointed list that would then be submitted to the governor, Nelson Rockefeller. And they did that sort of largely on their own. So I don't spend a whole lot of time talking about this in the book because other people have talked about it. But the point here is that what gets reified as the demands is actually the outcome of a process of narrowing down what these people actually wanted into something that was palatable and recognizable to the state. And so I asked, like, what are the consequences of us reifying these demands and treating those as the demands at the expense of all of these other articulations of desire, right? That's a demand. It's an articulation of desire that are being produced. And then a bigger question is like, where else might we look for demands outside of just the petition to the state? What does it say about our political imagination that we've been trained to think that demands are only that which are being issued to the state and that these are things that those in power then, you know, can sort of deal with as they want to, right? What if we change our thinking around demands to prioritize how people within the movement are addressing their broader constituencies within the movement? So all of this is important because we're talking about war here, right? Like, I'm talking about war in a very serious way, right? So unless you have some kind of leverage, which they knew they didn't, the Attica brothers didn't, they had 30 hostages, but like they knew from experience that the state would come in. They didn't think that they would come in and kill people, but they knew the state would come in. They didn't have any leverage. So they didn't have any reason to believe objectively that the state would come in and with a helicopter or a plane and take them to a non-imperialist country, to take them to, you know, Mozambique,
Algeria.
But the point is that other people who were politically aligned with them did take that seriously, and they were trying to make that happen. There was material progress towards that possibility. People were trying to figure out how to make that happen. It didn't happen. The fact that it didn't happen doesn't mean that it shouldn't be taken seriously. And I think the fact that it's not taken seriously is a consequence of the way that there's a narrative dimension to this war that I'm talking about. And the fact that people don't take radical demand seriously has to do with the outcome of this narrative war in which radical politics, ideas, and histories are criminalized and pathologized and made to seem as though they're immature, when in fact they were so threatening to the state that the state developed a whole counterinsurgency apparatus against it, including controlling the archive such that it becomes really hard to tell these stories in the future.
I guess I want to get into it as quick as possible because I have so much more I want to ask you about, but conversation about pacification and pacification reforms and what it has meant and what the implications have been on the Long Attica revolt or individual potential for rebellion for prisons and prison systems in the U.S. in particular since the period after Attica to bring in reforms that might have a true impact on the daily life and access of prisoners without changing the systemic structure whatsoever.
Pacification is etymologically linked to the word peace. So pacification is about the achieving of peace in the absence of justice, right? Martin Luther King talked about peace a lot. He talked about how, you know, the powers that be want to maintain a negative peace, right? Which is similar to what I just said, peace without justice. What would it mean to have peace and justice? So your question gets into essentially one of the key themes. I think all of this can be clarified if we understand that what the kind of war that I'm talking about, that the state is waging, is counterinsurgency warfare. Counterinsurgency warfare is another word for counterinsurgency. If you want to understand this stuff, there's a large primary literature on counterinsurgency, in which counterinsurgency actors like Frank Kitson or David Galula, or you could read David Petraeus's Counterinsurgency Field Manual, which you can download for free online. These people are telling you what they're doing. They're talking about their strategy, what they've done, how it works. I'm arguing that this strategy gets internalized within the prison system. So if you want to understand pacification, you can just read the literature on pacification. But one of the things they talk about, they're trying to disrupt revolutionary movements. That's the goal. It's colonial and imperial powers trying to maintain power in the face of growing anti-colonial struggles. And the specific, it's a way to respond to the specific kinds of war that emerge in the colonial context, which are different from great power wars. So the thing that's most important for counterinsurgents is to create divisions within the movement, to create splits within the movement. There's lots of ways to do that. One of the ways to do that is through reform. They talk about this very explicitly. David Galula, he has a quote in his, I've just realized it's not in the book. It should be in my book because it's so perfect. And it connects to what we were just talking about in terms of demands. His quote is, okay, if you're a counterinsurgent, what you do after you get control of the geography, in other words, after you, you know, use violence to subdue the fighting, then you look at the list of the demands of the militants. You cross out all the ones that you can't meet, and then you satisfy the demands that you can, the satiable demands. There are certain kinds of demands that are satiable to the state, that the state can grant. There are some that the state can't grant. The kinds that the state can't grant are delegitimized as unreasonable or whatever, whatever. The ones that can be granted are framed as, you know, reasonable, mature, whatever, whatever. And so counterinsurgents strive to grant those demands, but to do so in ways that intensify their power, intensify their hold over the population. And they do so in ways that are designed to create splits between different factions within a given movement. So reforms can be a very effective way to pull more people to your side, because it allows the state to say that it's meeting the needs of the masses. But really, when you look at the reason behind why these reforms are doled out, it's much more cynical. And so I'm arguing that prison reform needs to be understood within this context. Specifically, prisons are always reforming. That's a whole other thing. We could, you know, like, prison reform isn't one thing. It's a constant thing. But the way that prisons reformed, they're always reformed to improve the prison, to make it better, to make it more extensive, to make it larger. And so part of what I argue in chapter 5 of the book is to analyze prison reform through a counterinsurgent lens, to look at how, for instance, and I'll stop after making this example, lots of material improvements were developed in the wake of Attica. Like, people got better clothing, there was more food rationed out for each individual prisoner. But this was designed specifically to counter rebellion. Like, the intention behind it was to pacify the population. And at the same time that they were doing that, they knew that there was a population within the prison that could not be pacified by those reforms. And so those people were targeted for a different kind of programming, usually solitary confinement and other sort of arcane and draconian forms of torture. So part of what this does is, I think you mentioned, you know, it raises a contradiction. There's this tension here between the need to improve the material conditions of people who are experiencing intense forms of suffering, and we want to alleviate that, right? But counterinsurgency actors know that, and they also know that this alleviation will also have a stabilizing effect on this broader system, which is the system that's producing the harm in the first place. And so there's this tension here between the need to alleviate suffering and the need to build the capacity to have a real structural impact on the thing that's producing the suffering in the first place. And so all of this is sort of demystified through the post-Attica prison reforms.
And you get deep into it in your book in a way that I appreciate and is so powerful. I have three more questions for you, and we are over time, so I'm going to do my best. I think it's important to mention that your book has been banned from prisons in at least New York, Florida, Michigan, and California under allegations that it could incite riots. You wrote a powerful letter in response to that. I'm wondering if you could respond briefly for us, just to describe how you react to that charge.
Yeah, I mean, it's a self-indictment of the prison's lack of legitimacy. I mean, if a book can incite a riot, then what does that mean about the hold that the prison has on power? What does it mean? What does it mean about how people are being treated? If just reading something, what people don't want to riot. Like, that's not, people aren't sitting around wanting to riot because they know that that will cause suffering. So this idea that, like, just a book, you know, I mean, in some ways it's a glowing endorsement of the book, right? But in some ways it's a glowing indictment of the prison system, right? That the only way that this thing can stabilize itself is through authoritarian means of like totalitarian censorship.
As opposed to having some different version of a system that isn't constantly putting people at the edge of revolt and with the need of it. Yeah.
Right. Like, there's nowhere in the book that I say, you know, rebelling is good. The book doesn't endorse anything politically. It endorses that we think about things in a particular kind of way. But in fact, it shows the tremendous amount of trauma and harm the people who engaged in these actions endured. But they did it knowing that that was going to happen and did it anyway. But it doesn't say that people should do that. If you read the book, I don't think you come away with the idea that I should start a prison rebellion. Like, that's not right. So, but it doesn't, you know, it's like people are making their own decisions. They're thinking for themselves. They're reaching their own conclusions. And the folks who were engaged in that kind of action felt like they had no other choice. And so it definitely refuses to pathologize people who made those choices. And I think that also is really scary. It's something that prison administrators don't like.
That's right. You also talk about the violent acts that occur within prison rebellion as counter-violence. And of course, this counter-violence you're referring to is people doing something in reaction to the extreme violence of the prison system itself. Without having time to get into the counter-violence narrative, but understanding that that framing, as I was reading those descriptions, I couldn't help but in current events be thinking about the Al-Aqsa flood. Mm-hmm. And when Palestinian resistance fighters initiated it on October 7th of 2023, as we discuss actions taken that day, kind of in the public sphere, we are on a radio station, I often hear conversations devolve into arguments about what types of tactics Palestinian resistance fighters can use or can be accessible, particularly in a context where the violent actions of those fighters make outside critics, meaning you, yourself and myself, or anyone, most people listening here, uncomfortable. But I also understand it in a context of counter violence, right? You know, your book is focused on a different context. It's focused on U.S. prisons, but I'm wondering how you would explore the violence engaged in the Al-Aqsa flood. And just that's something that really kept coming to mind as I was reading your book. How neatly does it fit into your framing of counterviolence? And then more broadly, what does it mean to use this counterviolence analysis to understand anti-imperialist rebellion the world over? And in this context, of course, at the end of the Attica prison rebellion, the state came in and killed not only people who were rebelling, but also the guards who were hostages. And that, again, reminded me of Israel's Hannibal directive that instructs their military to kill Israelis in order to prevent them from being taken hostage. So I guess I'm just going to lob that at you because it's something that I couldn't stop thinking about in the parallels in the framing that you were offering in the book.
Yeah, not to mention the surfeit of sexual violence as being used as a weapon. I mean, we could go on and on about the similarities. You know, the thesis, that one of the big picture arguments of the book is that the prison is a paradigm. That if we understand what's happening in prisons, we understand how power is working in the broader world. So, you know, we've been talking about Attica, but we're really just talking about how politics and how war works in this context. The book came out October 31st, 2023. And the parallels are striking. Gaza, people have been calling, you know, Israeli human rights organizations have been calling Gaza an open air prison since, long before October 7th, right? And so, we have this grotesque spectacle in which, you know, so many of the dynamics that I laid out in terms of Attica are being played out here because Gaza's a prison. So there's this compression of all of the different power relationships. It becomes highly visible in a way that it doesn't, that it's not in the broader world. Before this happened, there were 2.3 million people in Gaza, which is roughly equivalent to the total U.S. prison population, right? So what we're seeing now is multiple Attica massacres happening every day for over a year now, right? The Attica massacre, 39 people were killed. It was the single bloodiest, single day encounter on U.S. soil since the Wounded Knee massacre of 1890, all right? And people compared it to the My Lai massacre in Vietnam, which people were learning about at roughly the same time that Attica was unfolding. There's multiple Attica massacres happening every single day right now. Those things are the parallels are undeniable. Regarding violence, Walter Rodney says that violence aimed at the recovery of human dignity and at equality cannot be judged by the same yardstick as violence aimed at the maintenance of discrimination and oppression, period. That's historian Walter Rodney. That's why I use the term counterviolence, right? So I'm talking about war, and I was well aware that people were going to say, oh, because you're talking about war, you're advocating violence. I think that we need to be able to distinguish between violence that's about recovering human dignity and violence that's about maintaining oppression. And we need to be clear about those things. And so that's why I use the term counterviolence.
Thank you, Ori. This is going to be my last question, even though I had two dozen more. I want to talk just briefly about the way you frame storytelling in the process of your book. You spent 10 years talking with people involved in the Attica Rebellion, talking with people involved in various prison rebellions and the Long Revolt. We referenced it earlier in the conversation that many of the various histories written about the Attica Rebellion, or for that matter, most other rebellions, the Watts riots, whatever, really rely on state sources, sources that are being attacked by the rebellions themselves. So there's an inherent bias in those sources. Now, most of us don't have the ability to spend 10 years doing in-depth research about some important historical rebellion or current rebellion. I'm wondering if you have thoughts or advice about how we can critically think about uprisings through lenses that aren't rooted in these state-centered and pro-government bias. Like, what tools do you think of that we can turn to learn about even ongoing uprisings, or perhaps ones in more recent past, without kind of falling victim to these defensive narratives from the state?
So the state has a very low opinion of our intelligence as people, as everyday people. They think that we're sheep that need to be managed, that don't have the capacity to think for ourselves, right? I think that that's wrong. I mean, I think that there are processes that are unfolding that are designed to produce that outcome, but I think that that is wrong just as an assertion. So I think that the state is already operating with a flawed theory of knowledge. So what would it mean to think about resistance in ways that assume that people are, that ordinary people, that people who are modestly educated, that people who belong to historically oppressed groups, that those people are intelligent, that they think they're acting in their best interests, that they have ideology and philosophies. So I think just that, right? What I just said a few moments ago, answering the last question, that people don't want to riot, okay? So if they do, then what does that mean, right? So just having that orientation towards actually looking for the internal logic of what ordinary people are doing, I think that could help us a lot. Because what we're going to be fed is a state narrative that is designed to demonize, criminalize, and pathologize all forms of resistance, and that refuses to look at their ideology as anything other than, you know, some kind of extremism that needs to be neutralized and dispensed with. Source criticism is another one. Just like, I mean, this is so important now because we live in a context of pervasive information warfare and deep fakes and all these other things. Source criticism, right? Thinking about where your information is coming from, right? It's not that the problem is not that the state sources are biased, because all sources are biased, especially in war. The problem is that the state sources get framed as the most objective, and their bias is then laundered as objectivity. And so what we think of as objectivity is in fact propaganda. That's the problem. So I think we need to develop really new and sophisticated methods of source criticism. And by that, I mean just actually spending the time to think critically about where, when, and how something was produced and for what purpose. And are there other sources that might speak to a different perspective? And then ultimately, one has to make a decision about how one wants to move forward with the existence of that narrative tension that's going to happen. And the choice you make is a political choice. And we're seeing that unfold now in real time in terms of just our very contentious information environment. So those would be some of the questions that I would encourage people to ask of themselves and of the information that they're consuming.
It's a task that I've been thinking about in a variety of ways, and your book is really helping me to frame that. I really appreciated your book. Orasanmi, we're going to have to wrap it up there. Thank you so much for joining us on KPFA today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And that was the voice of Orisomni Burton, author of Tip of the Spear, Black Radicalism, Prison Repression, and the Long Attica Revolt. He's also a professor of anthropology at American University. You've been listening to Law & Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a world where all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law & Disorder is produced at KPFA, that's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is co-hosted by me, Jesse Strauss, and Kat Brooks, and produced by me as well. Our show theme music is from Steve Raskin. Feel free to hit us up about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media, that's at lawanddis, D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you stream podcasts by searching for Law & Disorder with Kat Brooks. You can also find our content live on KPFA Radio or streaming at kpfa.org in the 8 a.m. Pacific hour, Mondays through Thursdays. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by listeners, and if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.